30 years ago, before he was a famous pet shop boy, Neil Tennant worked on Smash Hits, which, until it closed in 2006, was an amazingly successful pop magazine. Now, he and other Hits alumni remember the winter of 82 and his spell on the magazine in Neil Tennant's Smash Hit Christmas.
Hi, I'm Neil Tennant. I worked at Smash Hits from 1982 to 1985. The golden age of 80s pop music. Smash Hits was a unique voice commenting on this incredibly creative pop music scene. I have the brains, you have the looks. Let's make lots
of money. It was an anarchy of absurdism. I couldn't believe I could have that much fun and get paid for it.
There are more words in Smash Hits then than you'll find in The Guardian now.
Everything about Smash Hits was happy. It wasn't snidey, it wasn't sarcastic. It was about the wonderful world of being a pop star.
It just was purely the industry of fun.
What Smash Hits was about for me was telling readers pop music is brilliant. Look how amazing it is. And pop musicians can be hilarious.
We were really on the reader's side in a way that's unimaginable in the world of Simon Cowell. Must be something
inside. I was working in book publishing, but I was a big pop music fan. And for some reason, Smash Hits people asked me to write reviews. I think they knew I wanted to be a writer, but I had slight writing ambitions anyway. And so I wrote some reviews, and then they asked me to do an interview. I think the first interview I did was with the group Yazoo, Vince Clark and Alison Moyet. And then one day, the phone rang, and it was Dave Hepworth. Dave Hepworth's the editor. And he said, would I go out for lunch with him? And I knew, I thought, he's going to offer me a job.
The big project that brought him in was Peter Strong, who was the publisher, said, we ought to do a Smash Hits annual for the Christmas market. It's an obvious thing to do. And so I thought, books, I don't really know anything about books. All I needed was the love you gave. Oh, Neil knows about books. All I needed for
another day. And we went to a cafe and he offered me the job to edit his Smash Hits yearbook.
I remember he had shepherd's pie and then he had apple pie. And I thought, he's stringing this out, you know, so in the end he's going to say no, but he's going to think, I had two courses.
And when I got there, they announced I was also the news editor of the magazine. But anyway, what struck me when I got there was it was quiet. They didn't play music. And as I had the record player next to my desk, and of course records were flooding in all day long, and so I used to play them. Yeah, I remember Mark Allen saying to me, Mark Allen was the features editor, welcome to the world of free records.
Our publisher had this brilliant idea of attaching to Smash Hits the Panini sticker book, where you got six free stickers or whatever, and then you had to swap them at school and you could build up the entire collection. But we needed an advert for this, and we needed someone to record some music and do a kind of radio ad. And Neil said he would do it, and we actually had no idea that he was recording and making music at the time. And they recorded this track known as Six Free Stickers. Smash Hits collection of six free stickers, stick them all, you know, collect them all, this kind of thing. It was absolutely brilliant. I think you can honestly say it was probably the first ever Neil Tennant recording.
I'd met Chris Lowe in the middle of 1981. And so when I joined Smash Hits, Chris and I had already started writing songs together. And we were taking it reasonably seriously.
I can remember him playing Opportunities, that was one of the first songs they wrote. I'm ashamed to say I can still remember my reaction,
which is, oh, Neil, those are exactly the same chords as Hanging Around by the Stranglers. Try and do something original. It's a pretty ludicrous reaction, really.
Smash Hits has started life on the kitchen table of a magazine genius called Nick Logan, who was former editor of The NME and went on to found The Face and Arena.
It would be a photographic-based glossy with song lyrics, because I thought that was actually quite a good idea. Using the song lyrics was a way to avoid having to commission a lot of writing. I felt that I could do something that was mildly subversive with it.
And Nick's only assistant at the time was his 19-year-old sister-in-law, Bev Hillier.
The main part of the job was to really transcribe song lyrics. Smash Hits was a song lyric magazine, that was it. Song lyrics and features and posters. I'm in the bumble, just the one across the hall.
They had as the cover story often just the first lyrics to a song by whoever it be, Blondie or something, who was hanging on the telephone. Maybe you have the first verse of Hanging on the Telephone. For more lyrics, see page 27, but you kind of had to buy a magazine to get the whole song. You were probably working out some rather amateur choreography with some friends in front of the mirror, possibly involving, you know, hairbrushes from my friends. Those kind of things were of crucial importance and you needed the words.
Boy George came in with the lyrics. I mean, Simon Le Bon actually from Duran Duran came in, and Phil Oakey came in with some. I was the envy of all my friends, because also I'd been working at the Social Security office as a clerical assistant. I would go off to the Royalty in Southgate, go out to a club in the evening, the next morning just write about it, write about the DJs there, the artists there. That was fantastic. There was a section in the magazine called Bits, and Neil used to edit that. It had all snippets and different things and news about things that were coming up, groups, etc. I remember meeting him and thinking, oh wow, Neil was like a posh history teacher. But no, he was very sweet, and actually, because I was a big soul girl, I had a love of dance music, and Neil also liked dance music. I mean, he was a big fan of Bobby O, the American record producer. So Neil and I bonded, I think, through dance music, really. And we had pet names for each other. I used to call him Chili Tea, and he called me Bubbles. Smash Hits grew so quickly in the first year. I think it went from nothing to 200,000.
250. You just couldn't believe it was going up and up and up.
The readers were always taken very seriously, and at editorial meetings we discussed what are the readers like. It wasn't slapdash, there was nothing slapdash. We used to sneer at other music magazines because we thought they were a bit lazy and cliched. And Smash Hits invented its own cliches.
Every night, the 13, 14-year-olds of Britain went to their rooms, got out their Friends Forever notepaper and their multicoloured pen, and they wrote, believe it, wrote, actually with their hands, wrote long letters suggesting something you got wrong or somebody you ought to feature more or somebody they liked or whatever. I think Smash Hits was more instrumental in encouraging teenage literacy than all the education in the world.
Christmas 1982, I can remember that very clearly, actually, because the great revolution that happened, which I think was eventually called New Romantic, was Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet and, I suppose, Eurythmics, and Adamant, of course, obviously, were based on the idea of dressing up, and that was an extremely important part of it. I went to the first Spandau Ballet concert, actually, and there they were wearing jodhpurs, blouses actually, and sort of silk throws across their shoulders and tartan scarves. Now they looked absolutely fantastic. What they looked like was really important, and that was a major explosion for us. 1982 was a perfect coincidence for Smash Hits because the quality of the print and what we were trying to do, these were the perfect groups, custom built for that.
And everyone's got a look. The Culture Club have got a look. Duran Duran have got a look. Spandau have got a look. Frankie come along. They're outrageous. Bronski we come along with a gay rights manifesto, just happily spread across two pages in the front cover of Smash Hits. There's a dance music thing going on, electronic music. Smash Hits covers it before the NME does. Me and Dave Rimmer are playing hip-hop and Euro dance music all day long on the office record player by this point.
And by this point too, in 1983, Mark Ellen had taken over from me as editor.
I didn't care for Duran Duran's music or Culture Club or particularly for Spandau Ballet. But the point was that we were in it together. They needed to be on the cover of Smash Hits to sell records. We needed to sell magazines. And it was an absolutely wonderful synchronicity. And I really liked that because they didn't mind whether we liked the music or not. When you interviewed someone for The Enemy, they were always terribly worried that you were going to be nice to them in their face and stab them in the back and print. And that wasn't the point. Whenever we thought we were getting a bit too esoteric, Neil usually would go, it's a 12-year-old girl living in Grantham, this again, who is our reader. And that kind of focused our attention.
The cover, which was an incredible prize for any pop star, was really important because it didn't matter who you were, you were only on once a year. Dave Hepworth always used to say in the early 80s, Toya was very reliable at selling the magazine. She's an amazing pop star.
The image that they used on the cover in 1982 was for the cover of my single Brave New World. I was a very colourful artist. I was at the beginning of the video age. Image was important to me. I didn't feel I had a natural beauty to sell, therefore I created quite a strident, bold image that I felt presented me as a kind of Boadicea of the music industry.
Suddenly a transparency arrived in the office of Toya with a huge, great orange fronds of hair, as if she'd been plugged into the national grid, a great kind of explosion of hair. And then painted on her face was a series of tiny seagulls and great blue lines and clouds, all painted on her face. And this wasn't photoshopped or projected, this was actually done. And the picture looked so beautiful and so arresting. It would have such impact on the newsstands. And obviously she was on the cover.
It was the one paper that did not take the mickey out of you. Therefore, I could go on the front cover with birds all over my face and my hair bright pink and standing up on end, which back then was an absolute rarity. Very few people were dyeing their hair that colour. We would have the whole day to do the shooting. They never hurried us up. They never were pointing at their watches going, the budget's running out.
If we were doing a photo shoot, for example, we would all sit round in the office and go, what could we possibly get this pop star to do? Could we get Morrissey to hold a placard saying, meet his murder? Yeah, we could, actually. We could do that.
Quite a few of the people who started life on Smash Hits as designers went on to be editors and writers, and one of them was Lola Borg.
You could experiment. I mean, I don't remember anyone laying down any rules whatsoever about what I could or couldn't do. And that's the kind of thing, I seem to remember we used a sperm design for somebody, sperm swimming in the background for somebody else, and you could just get away with that kind of stuff and nobody ever noticed, really. I mean, probably the readers did, that was the point.
People were enormously cooperative. I mean, it was a yearbook we had in 1983, and there was a feature called Let's Pretend. And the idea was that you could just dress up as some kind of fantasy figure. And I thought Lee John dressed up as Julius Caesar, and David Van Day of Dollar dressed up as David Crockett, you know, the wild frontier. And my absolute favourite, I think I remember that Nick Haywood of Haircut 100 was dressed up as Dustin Hoffman on the cover of The Graduate album. And it's brilliant. And there he is in the same jacket that Hoffman's wearing, and the alluring stockinged leg appearing in the foreground, which in fact belonged to Anne Bancroft, I think, in the original. And I think they really like that. The FlexiDisc was an idea of Neil's, and it just shows you how huge the magazine was and how its pulling power. The idea was we could go and record everybody of any stature at all at that time and try and get them to do a Christmas message or a Christmas song or whatever.
The 1982 one was just really amazing because Mark got everyone.
Hi, I'm Simon Phillips. Simon, and from me, Roger.
Paul Weller even did it. Famous for being grumpy. Paul Weller.
Paul Weller, if I remember rightly. I stick the microphone in front of him, he's in a piano, and he goes, it's Paul Weller here. Don't let that stop you enjoying yourselves. And it's that brilliant idea that he just understood that Paul Weller automatically meant bad news. I think, you know, Bananarama, fantastic. They asked for what they want for Christmas. Was Al Pacino and six poodles. Everybody did it. You know, even ABBA recorded some kind of Christmas message.
Hello, this is Agneta of ABBA.
And this is Bjorn.
And this is Benny. And we wish you all...
Good Jul og Gott Nytt År.
And Mark's little linking device was that it was a party. Because Mark and Dave were also TV presenters on the Old Great Whistle Test, lest we forget, during this whole period.
Yes, yes. Well, it's just warming up, this party, really. Probably get a little out of hand on the flip side, know what I mean? Mind, huh? Lucky it wasn't a new one. Anyway, hang on, I'll get a broom.
He started to be joined in the office by this quiet character from Lancashire called Chris.
And Chris Lowe would sort of dance by the record player in a very, you know, low-key way, but he'd be grooving by the record player, and people were used to Chris hovering around.
And it slowly emerged that they'd started making records. And I don't think anybody took it seriously.
I can remember asking if you wanted to go to America and, you know, write something about the police. The police were a huge deal for our readers. And Neil, I knew for a fact, detested the police. He could see absolutely no merit in anything they'd done. And suddenly seemed extremely excited about going to America and wrote this piece, which described Sting as a bronzed Adonis, which I thought was fantastic, actually. But actually, what he was doing was, of course, he was trying to get a free trip to America to go see Bobby O, who was a high-energy record producer.
He was our kind of musical hero. In fact, Dave Hepworth made one of Bobby O's singles, Single of the Week at Smash Hits. Bobby O actually had two singles. I made a Single of the Week at Smash Hits song. And everyone knew Bobby O's records.
I remember this as one of the most extraordinary weekends of my life. So it's 1984, it's summer, it's in New York. Steve Bush and myself have flown over to meet Felix to talk about doing Smash Hits in the United States. We arrive in New York, we go to the Gramercy Park Hotel. Felix has moved me into a suite so that we can meet that weekend in the suite. It's big enough. Neil Tennant is out there, apparently, to see the police at Shea Stadium, but really to see his idol disco producer Bobby O with his demos that he's been quietly keeping to himself. Neil rings up the hotel and says, I'm coming around. I've ordered a load of beers. Neil turns up, he goes, guess what? Bobby O's going to make a record with me. The three of us sat there and we laughed and we laughed and we laughed till the tears rolled down our faces. And I'm a father, and therefore you're supposed to say your happiest moment in your life is the birth of your children. Apart from that, I remember thinking, this is the happiest moment of my life. Sometimes you're better off dead. There's a gun in your hand, there's a point into your head. You think you're mad, too unstable. Kicking in chairs and knocking down tables in a restaurant in a West End town. I came back from New York on that first trip. I played everyone three tracks that we'd recorded with Bobby O in New York. But there was one track where I sort of rapped, stroke, spoke, and I was too embarrassed to play it, and that was West End Girls. In a West End town, the dead end world. The East End boys and West End girls. Now West End girls. Now West End girls. Sadly, though, Smash Hits was not a success in the United States. The charts mattered in the UK far more than they mattered anywhere else in the world. And also, without being too pretentious, I think A.S. Byatt said that English is all about the constantly shifting tone of voice, and Smash Hits was all about the constantly shifting tone of voice. And if you couldn't catch all those messages, all those cadences, it was wasted on you.
And this style of writing developed, which had a lot of humour. Tom Hibbert had this sort of fantastic way of writing, very baroque.
Hibbs was like Smash Hits's P.G. Woodhouse. He was like the centrifugal force of all the insanity, the preposterousness. I'm Sylvia Patterson, and I was the staff writer up until 1990. I think it started with Mark Ellen, actually. Mark Ellen may have been the one who first dubbed Paul McCartney Sir Paul Fab McElwacky Thumbs Aloft McCartney. And from that, you had Tom with Morton Snorton Fortin Harkett out of Aha. Lord Frederick Lucan of Mercury, Mark, unpronounceable name from Big Country, Saucy Sir Samuel Fox, there was Mark Horrible Headband Knopfler, and the girl from Prefab Sprout was known as the Trout from the Sprout. And there was no malice in any of it.
Of course, it had to be the late lamented Tom Hibbert who got the job of interviewing Mrs. Thatcher for Smash Hits.
I bought a cheap suit from Mr. Byright and went along to meet the Iron Lady. And I asked her when Cliff Richard would be knighted. She said, always be serious. And now he is knighted, of course.
She trotted out this unbelievably dated old hokey about her favourite record with the Carol Girls now. Something like, how much is that doggy in the window? Obviously, Tom just trotted this out verbatim, and he made the very astute connection between the idea of how much is that doggy in the window and the obsession with the great economic boom. The idea that her favourite record would be one about how much something costs rather than what the music sounded like was quite an astute point.
After she'd banged on for three quarters of an hour, we wanted to take a photograph, and she insisted that I be photographed beside her. Come on, sit beside me. You'll always want to remember this day. And as it turned out, she was right.
And funny enough, with the Pet Shop Boys, when I left and Pet Shop Boys took off, that humour thing we had as well. And people relate to the Pet Shop Boys to this day in a kind of Smash Hits, Pet Shop Boys humour. And I guess I probably contributed to the humour thing in Smash Hits.
I saw this advert, it said a pop writer was wanted rather than music journalist, which I think is quite interesting. And it was in the Guardian media page. And I thought, that is absolutely what I want to do. I don't want to be a lawyer. This has to be my job. So I wrote a letter, and I wrote it in the style of Smash Hits. There was lots of inverted commas and jings and things like that.
Maybe it was the adventurousness of Smash Hits' love of language that attracted bright young writers like Miranda Sawyer to the magazine.
I suppose you could call it an early form of celebrity journalism, but it didn't really treat people like celebrities. What it did was try and discover what they were like, and to discover what people are like, it would use interesting questions. The classic idea is that we just said, oh, what colour socks do you wear, that kind of thing. But that's not actually what people did. What we did was think very, very hard about the questions we would ask people and make sure they were funny, but also would be revealing. So if you say to somebody, when was the last time you were sick in your shoes? You're not really asking them when was the last time you were sick in your shoes. You're actually asking them when was the last time you had a brilliant night out and what kind of night out was that night out. If you ask them, does your mother play golf? What you're actually finding out is what kind of parents, what kind of background you came from. These questions were funny, but they were also thought about.
It sounds like it was all glamour and fun. And in fact, we had this terrible thing called press day where we had to get on the train and go to Peterborough and go to the head offices and pass all the pages, and it was right next to a sugar beet factory, and it really stank. And I can remember getting the train with Neil Tennant, who was very enamoured with the Jewel in the Crown series, and he always used to do impersonations and say, there's a spot of bother down at the palace, I need to go off to the Pip down to the palace. He was always doing that kind of thing. But no, I also do remember Neil Tennant coming into the office and saying, oh, I've decided to give this up to be a pop star. And there was a bit of a silence and everyone looked at each other and thought, good luck.
I said to our manager, Tom Watkins, I would only leave Smash Hit when I got paid the same salary, which I seem to remember was £12,000 a year. Well, we got this big advance from EMI, so I left. But it was was a big move. At the time, Mark Ellen was going off with Dave to launch what became Q Magazine. So at this amazing period, 1985, just before Live Aid, I turned down being editor. But I thought, with the Pet Shop Boys, and signing with EMI, I thought we had a chance, and I'd always, my whole life, wanted to do this. And I thought, I'm going to go for it. When I left, we had a party in a little club off Carnaby Street, and they made me this mock-up of me on the cover of Smash Hits.
I think the main cover line was Neil Tennant, Screamer, how I left Britain's brightest mag to form my tragic pop group, went down the dump road and asked for my job back. And partly we couldn't really believe that the Pet Shop Boys weren't going to be successful because we'd all known people who were aspiring musicians, and none of those people ever had been successful, so we just assumed that anybody we knew were never going to make it.
As it happens, we were on the cover of Smash Hits, the real magazine, 7 or 8 months after. I mean, I look at the pop world today, and I miss Smash Hits.
The means of Smash Hits was related to two things. One is the systematic wrecking of the singles chart in the 90s, when Radio 1 said, no, we'll play records months before they come out. And at the same time, the world in which Smash Hits died was the world of MTV, of mobile phones, of pop gossip all over Fleet Street, and this stuff coming at you from everywhere. And so fun was absolutely everywhere.
It was the era of 20,000 people standing in a field. There was no personalities behind the dominant musical force at the time. There were no faces to put to pop culture.
I think it's a shame. You know, there used to be a fantastic, not just Smash Hits, but there used to be a really brilliant tradition of Saturday morning television being irreverent about pop, and that's just gone as well, really. So that joyful delight in pop music and delight in teasing the people that make pop music has kind of disappeared, really, and I think that's a shame.
That wonderful, light, airy optimism that we all experienced in the early 80s, I think, has gone. I now view fame as something really dark and slightly abusive, and I just don't think Smash Hits could survive today because people expect the negative angle.
When I look at the pop stars we've been through and the people who haven't been on the cover of Smash Hits, Amy Winehouse and Adele, and The Arctic Monkeys and One Direction, you know, it's a shame, really.
Neil Tennant's Smash Hit Christmas was produced by Susan Marling. It's a Just Radio production for BBC Radio 4.